This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Entertainment Technology World. We're about to speak to Rick Clow, who's the VP for Business Development at Feedburner in Chicago, Illinois. Welcome to Utopia Media's Entertainment Technology World.
Thanks, Mark. Pleasure to be here.
Why don't we talk just a little bit about your background before you came to Feedburner, especially regarding social text and what I guess I'm calling Wikimania.
Yes. Prior to joining Feedburner, was with Social Text, was head of business development there, worked closely with Social Text CEO Ross Mayfield. I think it's an exciting time for wikis. I think they're finally getting the mainstream attention that they deserve.
In fact, Michael Kinsley is trying to set one up for the LA Times editorial page, and
he's getting some flack
and getting some praise for it.
Well, I think it's evidence of a broader interest, I think, from the commercial side in understanding what these new technologies can do and how they can bring communities closer, build communities out, and make them part of the process.
What is Social Text as a company and as a genre?
Social Text is was the first company to commercialize the wiki concept and provide simple tools for groups to work together. The foundation is a wiki, but also includes some email management and other related tools.
Okay, and when did you come to Feedburner?
I joined Feedburner this spring, in April.
Okay, and talk a little bit about Feedburner's origins and what it was doing before you got there.
Well, the company started a little over 18 months ago. I think, fall of 2003. And I first became aware of the company early in 2004. I maintain a weblog and had seen some discussion about Feedburner on some of the weblogs that I was reading at the time, and decided to give it a try as a user. One of the things I was particularly interested in was knowing what my readership was through RSS. For those who aren't familiar with Feedburner as a company, we provide a couple of core technologies to publishers.
Tell us what those are, those core technologies.
Yeah, RSS is the technology not only behind podcasting, but grew out of the weblog boom that has happened over the last couple of years.
That's RSS for a really simple syndication.
That's correct. And it is an XML file format that makes it easy to distribute content from one website to many readers. And one of the challenges with RSS is that it's very difficult to know how many people are actually subscribed to that feed.
Right.
And the reason that is that as an individual, I use NewsGator as my aggregator. It's a program that monitors RSS feeds. And my copy of NewsGator checks every feed that I subscribe to once an hour, which means that individually I'm responsible for 24 hits a day to every feed that I manage,
right,
or that I monitor.
Right.
My Yahoo, on the other hand, may have 1,000 subscribers to a single feed, but might visit that feed only 4 times a day.
Right.
So there's really no way to reconcile 4 hits versus 24 and understanding how many people are behind each of those.
So in fact, the idea is to get feedback on feeds is essentially what you're doing.
Yes. One of those core services is to provide statistics for publishers. Originally, this was before the days of podcasting, originally weblogs and any news sites that were using RSS, to get visibility into how many people were actually reading that feed. Beyond that, another of the services we provide is understanding what's going on with that feed, not only how many people are subscribed, but what are they doing? How many times are they looking at the content in the feed, what we refer to as item views? And then finally, how many people are clicking through from links in the items of their feed out to the websites that are mentioned in those feeds? All of that data combined gives publishers a much more accurate view of what's going on with their feed.
Which, of course, is important to them so that they can modify or extend or augment or modify their own publishing approaches.
Absolutely. And as publishers became more and more commercially focused, which is to say not only folks who maintain weblogs who are looking to monetize their RSS feed, but also the professionals, the commercial publishers out there who were looking to adopt RSS because they recognize its value, but who need to be able to make a coherent business argument for why they should do that.
So if Vanity Fair or CBS News needs statistics to go to its advertisers and tell them what their cost per thousand is or other measures, they're going to need these kind of services.
Yeah, without something like FeedBurner, getting an accurate tally of how many people are out there, what the overall reach of that feed is awfully difficult and makes it very difficult as a publisher to start to predict out, you know, well, is our audience growing?
Right.
If it's growing, how much? If it is growing, what can we expect our ad inventory is going to be over the next 6, 12 months? Otherwise, it's just a shot in the dark.
Right. Well, what's an Atom feed, and how does that differ from RSS?
Atom is another format for the syndication of content. And in fact, it is both a syndication standard, similar in a sense to RSS.
Is it XML-based?
It is XML-based. It is also what's called an API, an application programming interface, to allow applications to talk to each other. It is currently at version 0.3, and we expect that Atom standard to go to version 1.0 in the very near future.
Okay, let's try to talk a little bit about the core technology here before we go and talk about some of the other aspects. What's involved exactly in the creation of the audio content or the text blog, and how does that get converted to RSS? Beyond that, what have been the technical challenges that you've had to deal with to upgrade and aggregate and coordinate all of these other aspects and that you've focused on in your R&D creates the product that you've got now? So start sort of with the basics and then talk about how you're adding value to the process and what you had to figure out in order to do it.
Absolutely. I think the first thing to note about RSS is that it should be very simple, certainly as a token of its name, should be very simple for someone who is creating content to create an RSS feed. And fortunately, most of the popular weblog applications today include an option to not only publish content to HTML so that it's visible in a web browser, but also published to RSS or Atom. So once that content is created, and in most cases it is as simple as checking a box in Blogger or Typepad or Movable Type, WordPress is another popular weblog application. Once any of those applications create content, they are most often also creating a syndication feed. FeedBurner.
One second. That's for text, essentially.
That's for text. That's correct.
How does that differ for people who produce? Let's say people are producing a Windows Media audio or even Windows Media video files.
Mm-hmm.
How do they bring that into the RSS environment?
Well, and that's you're hitting on one of the complexities that FeedBurner tries to simplify for folks. Typically, there's a couple of different answers to that, but most commonly, what we're seeing with a number of folks who are getting into podcasting, which of course is the distribution of frequently audio but can just as easily be video files, using RSS as its conduit for getting content out to subscribers, that they will use a weblogging application like Blogger or Typepad to create the feed, but are often they run into trouble when they have to figure out how to get their feed to be podcast friendly.
Right.
And that involves, the technical term for that is what's called an enclosure.
Okay.
Which means that the feed, the RSS feed, needs to include some code that points to the MP3 file, the Windows Media file. And that is often something that requires a little bit of programming understanding on the part of the user, which very often they simply don't have.
Okay, say again what an enclosure is and what its function is.
An enclosure is simply a little bit of code in the RSS feed itself that points to the MP3 file or the Windows Media file, whatever that rich media file is, which is designated by the publisher, the podcaster, as the one that they want distributed out to subscribers.
It's a little like the RA file versus the RM file in a real player?
Well, no.
So
the file in the enclosure could be a real media file.
Oh, okay.
Whether it's real audio or real video.
I meant in the sense of a pointer, where you click on the RM file, the R... A files went to the RM files in Real Player.
Sure. Okay, I hear you. The whole point of that enclosure tag, it's just a tag,
right.
Is to tell what's referred to as the pod catcher,
right.
Which is the client that handles the downloading of the audio and the syncing of that file to an iPod or whatever your media device is.
Right.
When it sees that enclosure tag, it knows to automatically download that file,
right.
And then transfer it to whatever playlist, whatever application has been designated by the podcast.
It's something of a broker or an agent or a little mini avatar that handles that functionality.
Yes. Now, where FeedBurner gets into this puzzle is to try and simplify the process and
right.
say to anyone creating a feed, all you have to do is create a link using HTML, or in many cases, you can just use the WYSIWYG editor, right? You can highlight a word, click the hyperlink button, and type in the address to the MP3 file.
Right.
And as long as you can do that, which most people in a point-and-click world can follow the two or three steps needed to simply point their application like Blogger to that feed, we will watch for any links to media files, MP3 files, Windows media files, etc. And as soon as we see them in the feed, we will automatically include an enclosure tag that is coded properly that can talk to the Podcatcher clients and have them handle the downloading.
Okay.
So that the producer of the audio only needs to worry about the creation of the audio.
Right.
And a simple, here's where the MP3 file lives. They don't need to understand anything else about how the feed works or the enclosure tag. They just have to know that, hey, as soon as I link to it here, FeedBurner takes it, does whatever it needs to do, and people who subscribe get the audio automatically.
Okay, two questions. Say more about the podcatchers. Who makes them? How do you get them? Are they generic? Are there value-add? Are there ones that are better than others?
The answer to that is yes. There are a whole host of applications out there that are podcatchers today. Some of the most popular are iPodder at iPodder.org, iPodder X, which is a Macintosh-only client. They're working on a PC version. Doppler, Doppler Radio is the name of that application. That's at DopplerRadio.net, is a popular PC application.
So essentially people then go to those sites, get those products, install them, and then they're ready to become part of the podcasting audience.
Correct. And all they need to do then with those applications is add a feed. And there is often a button that says add a feed, that they can type in a feed directly, they can browse to a directory, like Podcast Alley or podfeed.net are two popular directories of podcast feeds. All they need then is that feed, and the podcatching client will take care of the rest.
And again, they sign up for that. Either they're on a page, they're on a site, on a page, and they see it, add this feed, or they can go to these aggregators of links to add the feeds.
You got it.
Okay.
Now, some of this will be simplified. Steve Jobs, as has been very widely reported in the last couple of weeks, has announced that in the next version of iTunes, which should be shipping in the next about 6 weeks, I believe,
right?
Version 4.9 will include support for podcasting.
And what's that going to do to the? What's that doing to the business?
Well, I think it's a further validation of this as a mass media opportunity. That it is not a fringe marketplace by any stretch of the imagination. I think we'd all agree that we're very early in the growth of podcasting. But
right.
when you have an industry giant like Apple that has nearly, I think, 80% market share with its music device, the iPod,
right.
and a very popular Windows and Mac music management program in iTunes,
right.
indicating that the major enhancement they're making to their application is to support this new medium of file distribution, I think it's a very important validation of podcasting as something that will be supported by millions of individuals instead of the hundreds of thousands that are doing it today.
And of course, Apple is kind of unique in that it's both a computer giant and a cutting-edge company.
Well, I think certainly in the sense that they have squarely placed themselves in the middle of the entertainment media,
right?
And with iTunes being such a large focus for them, both with their various music devices like the iPod, the Shuffle, and the iTunes Music Store,
right.
This promises to be a very important development.
It's pushed them up into the Fortune 500.
Yeah, it's amazing. Who would have thought it several years ago?
And in fact, signing up with Intel to make their chips, they may be trying to get into, if the hundreds of thousands and millions of people who are using iPods now, actually some of them go to work and work in enterprises as well, maybe they're going to start bringing Apple into the enterprise as well as a computing platform. It's possible.
I think you're right. I think there's been a lot of speculation about what the Intel announcement really means, and I think he's still got a few surprises up his sleeve.
Okay. Thanks for explaining the basic technological process here. Let's talk about the commercial side of this now. Who's paying for what in this process, and who's getting paid for what in this process? And especially, how does FeedBurner fit into all of that?
Well, our core business is managing feeds, helping publishers understand what's going on with their feeds and monetizing their feeds through advertising where they choose to. So if a publisher says to us, you know, I want to insert ads in my feeds, we will help them do that by working with companies like Google or Yahoo Search Marketing. We also have advertisers who approach us directly and say, we want to be advertising in digital photography feeds. We want to be advertising in Mac-specific feeds. Travel feeds, et cetera.
You know, talk about how this advertising appears and whether, as with Google AdSense and AdWords, the advertisers pay and the publishers are paid on the basis of clicks on links versus what happens in a print magazine or on television where the advertisers pay the producers of the content for the number of people who look at it rather than the number of people who click on it.
You've hit on, I think, a very important distinction, which is to say that in the online world, there are two primary ways of paying for advertising. One is the traditional model, which you've laid out for magazines, which is CPM, or cost per thousand,
right,
where an advertiser will say, I'll pay $5 for every 1,000 people that will see this ad.
Right.
And then a site has, you know, 2 million impressions, and therefore, you know, you end up getting several hundred dollars for access to those people. On the other hand, Google has popularized, along with Yahoo Search Marketing, the notion of cost per click, which is that the advertiser will pay a certain number of cents or dollars per click, where that ad may be seen a million times, but
right,
if only 10 people click, and,
right,
you know, 50 cents per click, you know, there's only $5 that's going to change hands.
And the where it changes hands, essentially, Google takes half of it and the publisher gets half of it.
Google's taking a piece of every part of that transaction.
Right.
So FeedBurner's answer to that is that it really depends. We will do both, and we do both models today.
Okay.
I see RSS, the RSS audience, as being probably, in the long term, more amenable to a CPM model than a CPC model. And part of the reason for that is CPC is really geared towards people who are searching for content. And when you have that, you know exactly what they're looking for, and the way you target ads that are presented to them is to figure out which ads are most likely connected to what those people are searching for.
So this is really good for micro-segmentation. If there are people who are interested in digital photography, underwater digital photography, and there's a feed that provides all this information there is about that, you know, if you sell underwater photography equipment, those are the people you want to talk to and know about your products.
That's correct. Now, in the event of RSS feeds, you already have a subscriber who has indicated, I want this publisher's content.
Right.
Whether this publisher is a magazine, a newspaper,
right.
a website, a blogger.
Right.
And therefore, they're not necessarily seeking a particular piece of content out.
Right.
They are far more likely to be interested in the overall category that the individual or the site writes about.
Exactly.
Therefore, trying to micro-target an ad to a particular piece of content, the individual that is looking at that piece of content may have no interest in that piece of content. Therefore, targeting ads to it is not likely to succeed.
Right.
So you're more likely to succeed when the ads are focused on the overall category of site, the overall relationship between the publisher and the subscriber. So we're seeing both models be tested out today. We continue to work with advertisers and publishers to gather the data that helps all of us determine what are the best models for that. Now, in the podcasting world, of course, it's a little bit different because in many cases, the consumer of the content doesn't, in fact, see anything.
Right.
They're only listening to an audio file.
Like radio.
That's correct. So we are working with publishers on a variety of different approaches that would help podcast producers monetize their content in a couple of different ways. And the answer there, you're right, it is like radio, except that it may be some guy sitting in his basement creating an audio feed.
Right.
And he doesn't have the sound mixing board to fade in ad number one, ad number two, ad number three, and then come back to the studio.
Right.
It's just him. So we have some constraints that radio doesn't have. We also have some opportunities. And it's much earlier. Of course, podcasting didn't exist 9 months ago. So we're early in helping those publishers and producers figure out how best to incorporate commercial aspects without harming the medium.
Now, are you, enhancing the medium? Are you going to be involved possibly then in doing that kind of engineering, that sound engine, that audio engineering, so that people could present you with the audio, the raw audio clip, and the advertisers present you with the ads, and then you essentially edit them together?
I think it's a little early to say for sure. My guess is that particular approach takes us a little bit outside of our core focus.
Are there other companies that might make that their core focus and then forward the stuff to you?
I absolutely. I think we're already talking with several providers who are looking at hosting podcast files, the actual MP3 file,
right,
and are investigating how they might best either splice ads in. I think it's a little early to know exactly how that's going to play out, but clearly we see our core competency being in the management of the feed, providing the statistics to the publishers about how many total people are subscribed, what they're doing with those feeds, et cetera.
And then what else do you do to expand the audience for those feeds?
Well, in fact, while we're on this call, our CEO is making our latest announcement about a new service that we've turned on as of today, which is particular to podcasters.
Tell us about it.
Specifically, what that does is it allows us to expose data about the feed in the feed itself. So, for example, if I run a popular podcast and there are 5,000 subscribers who listen to my podcast each week,
right?
The fact that there are 5,000 subscribers is relevant for any directory of podcasts out there.
Right.
Right. So let's say you're looking for podcasts and you say, I really want to know what's popular. I want to know what other people are listening to. That's a pretty good benchmark for whether it's useful content or not.
This is like the studios publicizing their weekend and overnight totals and television shows giving out their ratings.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we allow feed publishers, podcasters, as well as the text publishers like weblogs, etc., to expose that information so that directories can incorporate it into their database. So if you went to podfeed.net today, you could take a look at their directory. And in addition to seeing information about the feed, like who produces it, how often do they publish content, what category of content are they, you'll also see a number that says this particular podcast has 700 subscribers.
What is that feature? What is that service or feature called?
It's called our Awareness API, Application okay. Programming Interface.
Right.
And it's something that allows aggregators like Podfeed, like NewsGator, like others, to expose that information to their users so the users can have it as one more data point to help them determine what content is interesting to them.
Okay, we're going to talk about this a little bit more later, but maybe we can sort of preview it a little bit here. This publication of essentially metadata about the feed is going to be useful essentially in sorting out the million podcasts. So it looks like it's going to sort of be strange attractors. The early feeds that attract a lot of subscribers are going to by that reason, I think, attract more subscribers and therefore more advertisers and therefore more quality programming and therefore more audience. Is that a likely scenario?
No doubt about it. I mean, if you go back 10 years ago to when the web was just starting to reach broad awareness,
right.
Every time some new large entity made a commitment to start publishing its web address,
right.
They brought people into the web that weren't previously using it.
Right.
And as soon as that person came, they didn't just go to trackapackage@fedex.com.
Right.
Suddenly they realized they could go to CNN.com.
Right.
And they could go to NewYorkTimes.com. And they could go to AOL.com. And before you knew it, you were expanding the overall market of web users.
Right.
In much the same way today that we're watching this network effect play itself out as larger podcasters show up.
Right.
Rush Limbaugh announces he's podcasting. Suddenly
right.
You've got tens of thousands of people who are going to listen to Rush Limbaugh on their iPods.
Right.
Well, they're not only going to listen to Rush Limbaugh.
Right.
They're going to seek out other podcasts that are interesting to them, which means that adding one new show increases the likelihood that each subscriber they bring is going to subscribe to 10 other shows.
I don't know whether it's a overblown or underblown comparison, but when the Beatles got people interested in rock music, they got interested in other bands besides the Beatles, and it's essentially at that level, it seems to me.
Well, and I think Rush Limbaugh would appreciate the comparison of him to the Beatles.
Although I can hardly think of two more disparate content providers than those two entities. Talk a little bit about the numbers of people who are podcasting and listening to podcasting now.
Thanks to the ease of starting one and the lack of any central directory, no one has an exact number of how many podcasts are out there. The most widely publicized figure was Steve Jobs' claim at last week's Worldwide Developer Conference, where he said there were 8,000 podcasts that we know about.
Okay.
So that's anybody's best guess. Personally, I'd say it's probably somewhere between that number and about 10,000.
Could you? What do you know, in either through statistics or just from feel and conversation? What's on them? What are they about?
Absolutely anything. Of our top subscribed podcasts, and I should mention, by the way, of that 8,000 to 10,000 number, over 6,000 of them are being run through FeedBurner.
Right.
So whether we have 75% of the market or 60% of the market, we have certainly a majority of the podcasts are being run through FeedBurner. And as you look at our statistics and you go through the top subscribed feeds, in the top five are IT Conversations, which is a professionally produced collection of interviews with various industry leaders in the technology field.
Right.
Catholic Insider, which is a priest who was doing podcasts from the Vatican
right.
during the selection of the new pope. We have DVD Talk by a guy named Jeff Kleinman in Portland, Oregon, who talks to movie directors, actors, movie enthusiasts. Once, I believe it's published once, maybe twice a week. There is a personal favorite of mine. They happen to podcast from the town that I live in called Croncast, which is a husband and wife team that they simply three times a week talk for a half hour or so about raising kids, living in the suburbs, what they find interesting, telling stories about growing up, and everything in between.
Okay, so we got religion and technology and entertainment and raising families.
Absolutely. And those are just a few of the top feeds. I mean, I think for every possible interest, you can find at least a half a dozen people or more talking about it, and that number is growing. We're adding to that number of podcasts, double-digit percentage growth every month.
And what would you say the audience figures are, similar caveats about the inability to get them exactly right?
Well, sure. And you know, this is an important note, right? One of the benefits from a user's perspective of RSS is that it's largely anonymous.
Right.
We can't track to find out what Bill is listening to.
Right.
But we can know that there are 500 people listening to a particular show.
Right.
But we just recently looked at all of the podcasts that we manage and tried to get some understanding of what the trends were. Across all 6,000, about 6,100 podcast feeds that we host, the average subscription number, average circulation, is about 33.
Right.
Now, if you take out the feeds that have fewer than 5 subscribers,
right,
which is a fair number of them,
right,
the average average circulation jumps to over 60. So that means of the 6,000 feeds that we manage, there's just over 200,000 listeners
right
today. And that number is climbing, I think it's somewhere 15 to 20% a month.
And, of course, this is likely to follow the path of personal computing and Internet use and so on, that these are the early adopters. They're going to tell their friends. They're going to start. Jane Lennon will start making jokes about it and so on, and eventually it's going to permeate the entire culture.
The latest estimate from, I forget which survey it was, but the latest estimate from one of the analyst firms was that I think by the end of next year we will see over 10 million people using podcasts at some level. And certainly as you start seeing the professional adoption with folks like Rush Limbaugh, you'll see that number start to jump exponentially.
Okay, on that subject, I want to just mention two things that I noted in the last few days as I was starting to get into this subject myself. Michael Eisner was sort of doing an exit interview as he's leaving Disney with Charlie Rose, and he was talking about what he's going to do next, and they were trying to focus on where the cutting edge is and what can be done. He exactly, without using the word podcasting, said it has to do with the distribution of the content we're making and new ways of distributing it and so on. And that was two nights ago. Last night, Jim Lehrer of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer was talking to Charlie Rose, and he was talking essentially, again, without using the word, about podcasting segments of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer show, making it available that way, and Charlie was getting in on it too. It seems that even the titans of mainstream media, the more aware ones are obviously aware that this is where things may be going.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and the pointers are everywhere. I had a meeting this morning with a large publishing enterprise that publishes a number of newspapers, and we were talking about the fact that several dozen newspapers, folks
right
that print for a living,
right,
are now podcasting. And we're eager to jump on this train because they recognize they need to be reaching their community of listeners.
Right.
Right? They're not thinking of them just as readers anymore.
Right, because you can listen to a podcast when you're stuck for 2 hours on the freeway in Los Angeles where you can't read the LA Times.
That's absolutely right. So
okay.
I think this whole notion of what RSS did for content distribution,
right,
it is now doing for file distribution. And it makes it much easier to get your content into the hands of people who want to read it, listen to it, and watch it. We'll see this happen with video as well. I think we're only another 6 to 12 months from seeing this become a major element of video distribution.
Okay,
it's already happening.
We're going to talk about this impact in a little bit more, but to talk about some of your products, the Smart Feed service that was just announced, what is the Smart Feed service, and what is it going to do for publishers and audience members?
In particular, the most recent announcement was about a mobile server for SmartFeed. We had introduced the notion of a SmartFeed for publishers several months ago, so that You as a publisher can worry about getting your content into some format that FeedBurner can understand, and then let FeedBurner worry about getting that content into the hands of each reader that asks for it.
Right.
There are more than 700 aggregators out there polling our 62,000 feeds today.
Right.
And that number is going up by almost, I think it's 50 or 60 a month. So every month we're finding more and more applications that are reading RSS feeds. What that means is, with only one exception, every aggregator in the top 20 lost market share over the last 6 months. As a result, there's more fragmentation in the marketplace, and publishers are being forced to understand what all the various requirements are in order for their content to be viewable on all of those in all of those applications.
Right.
What the SmartFeed mobile server is designed to do is to let publishers get their content into mobile devices, right? BlackBerries, Trios, cell phones, any multifunction device, a PDA that has wireless access, whatever it may be.
Right.
Without the publisher having to know all of the various device limitations.
Or having to spend the time reformatting their content.
I mean, there are literally dozens of these platforms today. The number will only go up as more devices get smarter and get easier access to connectivity.
Up to refrigerators and stoves.
Exactly.
Right.
So we let publishers worry about the business they're in, which is creating the content. We worry about managing the complexity of that feed to ensure that the publisher's content is viewable everywhere that someone wants to see it.
Now, is that smart feed system in place?
There's really two elements. Any individual publisher that runs their feed through FeedBurner has access to the smart feed service. The smart feed mobile server is an extension of that technology with some specific functionality that extends it to support a wide range of mobile devices. Both are in place today, and both are available for use. Of course, anyone using the FeedBurner service can turn their SmartFeed service on, and publishers who want to provide dedicated support for mobile devices and optimize their content for mobile devices can work with our SmartFeed mobile service.
So, in fact, where this almost can go, you know those people who stand at the corners with the little arrow saying, come see the house for sale or something, with ubiquitous Wi-Fi in cities, people could hang a flat panel screen on their back, hook it up to a Wi-Fi device, use the smart and using SmartFeed and these other products, essentially be walking billboards, couldn't they?
Well,
with the video content.
I mean, I think your point is a good one, which is, you know, RSS increasingly becomes the de facto standard for distribution of content, whatever
right.
that content may be.
Right.
And ensuring that it is viewable on every platform. You know, one of the advantages we have is that we see all of these applications because we manage so many feeds.
Right.
And we are in the best position to know, hey, look at that. Somebody just came out with a new Linux-based aggregator that we've never seen before.
Right.
We better understand its behavior and its limitations so that we don't send it any content that it can't handle.
Okay. Now, why don't we sort of move towards wrapping up by moving into the implications of all this and what it's likely to do by way of affecting viewing habits and the continued viability of companies like Viacom and so on, which itself just split into two parts. Going forward, with the knowledge, of course, these are all forward-looking statements by definition and subject to change at any moment.
Well, I think the best analogy that I've heard to explain RSS to someone that doesn't know it very well is to use the example of TiVo. What TiVo did for television viewing, which was to shift it so that you watched the TV you wanted when you wanted to watch it, without having to worry about complex programming of the VCR, without having to worry about program schedules.
Right.
When you sit down at the couch, you've got a dozen things that you would like to watch.
Right.
RSS does for your websites, for your news, for your photos, for your audio, right, in the form of podcasting. It shifts the content to the time and the place that you want to be.
This is what Steve Jobs called it at the Worldwide Developers Conference, TiVo for the radio.
That's right. And, of course, he was focusing specifically on podcasting. I think there's an equally important notion here for anyone producing text, which is your viewers, your readers, want to be able to consume your content.
So this is like a pull rather than a push technology.
It is.
And to put it in terms of French intellectual deconstructionists, this deprivileges the publisher, particularly if they're a mega corporation, and it privileges the viewer and puts them in the driver's seat.
It gives. I think you're onto something there. It gives the end consumer of the content, the reader of the content, control over what they consume. They say, I want this feed. If they no longer want that feed, there's no unsubscribe they need to do, which forces you to wait until the publisher chooses to allow you to opt out. You just stop receiving the feed.
Right.
You turn it off.
And with your statistics, you'll be able to tell the publishers who's listening and watching and how much and what they're doing.
Well, with a caveat. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, RSS is largely an anonymous technology.
Right.
We can't tell you that Mark and Susan and Ali and Bill are all reading this or watching that or listening to that.
Right.
But we can tell you in the aggregate what the overall circulation is, much
right.
like a newspaper knows what its circulation
right.
is, which is an important data point that they otherwise don't have. Certainly, we can help publishers understand whether they are gaining or losing subscribers, which is an important thing for them to know that would be almost invisible to them without using a service like FeedBurner.
And it can be done pretty much almost in real time, can it?
Yes, it can. It absolutely can. As far as the implication for some of the larger media companies, I don't think this is a threat to them, so long as they start adjusting and recognizing that while it does empower the end user, it creates an entirely new mechanism for them to reach the communities that they are engaged with.
And in fact, they can repurpose. If they're not in the basement, they're in the Skywalker Ranch or wherever, and they're already producing massive amounts of highly organized, highly produced, scripted, written, post-edited content, which all can be converted into this format.
Absolutely. On the audio and video side, certainly they're going to have access to technology that doesn't exist in your average living room. On the other hand, ultimately, anyone that's in the content business, RSS is ultimately a content-enabling technology. Good content will thrive in an RSS world.
Okay, let's wrap up with focusing on the two sides of that equation, the production side and the consumption side. This is going to mean that one person in his or her basement or home office is able, in essence, to produce content that can compete on something of a level playing field with what Viacom can do and what CBS News can do. What do you think is going to be the trade-off there? What are the key elements that a one-person shop versus a mega corporation, how's that going to play out? What is it that individuals can do that would make their content comparable and competitive with the content produced by big corporations?
Well, I think, you know, I mentioned my friends Chris and Betsy who produce Croncast, right? And they're doing this from their home.
Right.
They have a flair for very relaxed, easy conversation. They happen to both be very funny individuals, and the result is a very entertaining half hour three times a week where my wife, who doesn't listen to podcasts and kind of lets me be the one focused on the technology in the family, nevertheless, it made her get into podcasting because she overheard it one day playing on my computer and said, my God, who is that? They're great. I'd love to hear more. I think that it gives people like them an opportunity to reach a wider audience, certainly, than they would have had otherwise. And we've already seen the crossover, right? Adam Curry, former MTV VJ, moved back to Europe. A lot of people hadn't heard from him for a number of years. He's been referred to as the godfather of podcasting. He started podcasting from his home in Europe. 6 months later, he has himself a four-hour-a-day show on the Sirius radio network, where he is now podcasting and also broadcasting. So he is both producing his own content from his house in England and also collecting content from podcasts around the world and then collecting all of them and putting out a show on satellite radio.
Right. So the podcasts are then going back into the broadcast platform.
That's right. I really don't think this needs to be an either-or, whether it be for the text, right, the newspapers and the magazines of the world,
right,
any more than it needs to be an either-or for the audio.
Right.
I think this ends up being mutually beneficial. The network effect I talked about earlier, I think, plays well in both sides.
Okay. Let's talk finally about what this is going to mean essentially for broadly speaking, culture, that in the old days, in the 60s, there were three television networks that were virtually identical and that produced the news that most, that 90% of the people watched. Through the it's through cable, and there are 40 news channels. This is creating, podcasting is creating the possibility for hundreds of thousands of channels. What's that going to be? People who met for the first time when they were 20 and had lived in different places could say, well, you know, we have in common this television series that we saw when we were 14. What's going to be the impact, do you think, and it's, of course, speculation, on essentially the mindset of the population based on the fact that people will have access to hundreds of thousands of news channels and entertainment channels and different media experiences? What's that going to do overall, do you think, to the culture and people's psychology?
Well, there was a fascinating article just under a year ago in Wired magazine called The Long Tail, and it looked at the warehouse shelves, if you will, at Barnes & Noble, Borders Books, and compared them with Amazon.com,
right,
and realized that the average Barnes & Noble, I think, stocked something like 80,000 books.
80,000 titles.
Correct.
Right.
And that Amazon, half of Amazon's sales came from books that have never seen a Barnes & Noble shelf.
Right.
In other words, what the author of this article called The Long Tail were 80,001 to 500,000. Which was these potentially low interest,
right?
They might only have 10 sales per title or two sales per title.
Right.
But that there was a tremendous amount of interest in shoppers at Amazon.com for these titles that otherwise they would never have had access to.
Right.
And I think we're seeing that same notion of access to content that, that there is a community for. We used to define community by geography, right? We all live in Manhattan, or we all root for the Red Sox,
right,
or whatever that might be.
Right.
Increasingly, what I think podcasting, weblogging, what RSS in general has enabled is an opportunity for like-minded individuals to find each other, when in the past that was very, very difficult. So I think it's changing our notion of community. I don't think it's destroying it any more than I think it's completely radically changing it. I think it's just making it different for how those communities find each other and sustain each other.
All right. I want to thank you for your part in building that community.
Well, I appreciate the time, Mark. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and hope that the information's been useful.
I'm sure it has and will be. Thanks again.
All right. You bet. Take care.
Bye.